see. In 1960, you moved to the University of Pennsylvania and School of Medicine, although all of your early papers for about the first 10 years came from the Johnson Research Foundation. What was the distinction?
It used to be the Johnson Research Foundation / Department of Biophysics. And when I came here, the first time I came with my husband, he was being offered the Donner Professorship of Physics. Neither the head of the Johnson Foundation nor the head of biochemistry was here. I mean, they both happened to be out of town at the time. Well, so I talked to someone who was the head of the graduate medical school of biochemistry, who didn't even know who I was, so it didn't matter. See, Chance worked in oxidative phosphorylation, so he knew me.
Who's this?
Britton Chance, who's
right.
He was the director of the Johnson Foundation. And I will tell you that the Johnson Foundation was far better known as a research institution than the Department of Biochemistry here. It was a research foundation. They had no teaching at all. And so the concentration was entirely on research. And it was independent, had an independent endowment. But it was also the Department of Biophysics of the medical school. So after I got back to St. Louis after that first visit, a week later, Chance called me up and asked me to come back. He'd come back in the meantime, found out that I'd been here and that we might come here. And so he asked me to give a seminar. It was really amusing. I had such a large audience. They were all so curious about a female scientist at that time. It was still fairly rare.
The lightning hadn't
arrived. Anyhow, I came and I gave a seminar and he immediately offered me a job as an associate professor. So I accepted it. And then I got back, and maybe I accepted it after I got back or something. I talked to Corey about it, because Corey was very wise about all these things. I remember when I complained to him when I was going to Harvard about how little they were paying me. He said, "Mildred, the less they pay you, the more independent you can be." I thought, well, if they pay me nothing, I have true independence. Anyhow, I told him about it, and this place, the Johnson Foundation, had some drawbacks to it that were well known. He said, "Look, why don't you get yourself an appointment in biochemistry, too? In case you don't like it, you can move over to biochemistry." So when I came for the next visit, I wanted a joint appointment then, you see, in the two departments. I went to see the chairman of biochemistry. I should tell you that he knew about it because that I was coming, because one of the people in the department who was a full professor I had known very well in the past, and he immediately sent him a telegram and told him of this possibility of my coming here and urged him to offer me a job, which he didn't do. But anyhow, when I came the second time, he was here, and I went over to see him, and I said I would like a joint appointment because, after all, I felt I was a biochemist more than a biophysicist. And he said, yes, I could have a joint appointment, but I would have to teach, and they couldn't pay me anything. I could have this appointment as a sort of honorary thing, but in return for that, I would have to teach. So I said, no, thank you. I think the first year or two, at any rate, I want to spend my time getting my laboratory going. And that was that. Now, many years later, the school decided that the two departments should merge. So the department became the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics.
After you came as an associate professor, and within a year you were...
Yeah, well...
Is that another story?
No, well, Chance, I must say this for him, he's only interested in one thing, whether you produce or not.
I see.
And when he saw, after a year, he realized that I certainly was as good as any full professor around, he just promoted me.
Oh, okay.
There was nothing special about it. Well, it was kind of special because I'd only been an associate professor. I'd only had a faculty appointment for 3 years. and he made me a full professor.
Right. That's what was a little surprising about.
Well, he doesn't go by the book. He, I mean, first of all, it was ridiculous that it took me 21 years to get a faculty appointment, you see. I will say this for Chance, there is absolutely no bias, race, religion, sex. It doesn't matter to him.
You just produce.
Mm-hmm. He's only interested in what you produce.
Did you, by that time, have some very general objectives in terms of the direction in which you were going? I mean, you could work in isotopes early on. You'd been an expert in isotopes, and then you did work in PMR, and then in NMR, and this sort of physical organic chemistry. Much of the time in phosphates and stuff.
Yes, I was interested. Yes. I mean, that's a very important aspect of biochemistry, you know, the
right.
biochemistry of phosphate compounds, because the reason that compounds get phosphorylated is to keep them in the cell. I mean, you take up glucose, but you don't take up any glucose phosphate compounds. And, of course, ATP is so universal, and it functions not only as a source of energy in these, you know, it's the central reservoir of chemical energy in all cells, but it also has regulatory roles and all kinds of roles, and it's very important energy transduction and muscle contraction, luminescence, and so on.
So basically, you wanted to understand the chemistry of
ATP. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the, I thought, a fascinating compound, which has so many functions.
Yeah.
And it's the substrate of the first step in all macromolecular synthesis.
Right.
Whether it's protein or nucleic acid, there it's actually incorporated. But whether it's protein or phospholipid or whatever, it's always ATP, or in the case of phospholipids, it's CTP, but it's the same thing. And carbohydrate metabolism, glycogen formation, starts with the first step is GTP. But anyhow, it's the triphosphates that are so central to all of these basic phenomena in the cell, basic chemistry of the cell.
Right.
I've gotten off on nucleotides. I mean, I've done a little work on nucleic acids, metal binding to tRNA and so on, but basically I have been interested in the chemistry in explaining the function and role of ATP. In chemical terms, of course.
Your first important paper, I guess, from here was with John Lay, where you used the...
John Lee. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where you use proton relaxation rates.
Yes.
For the first time, and you...
Well, the metal ion paper was on metal ATP was published from here, though I did most of the work at Washington U. I did a few experiments after I came here.
Right. Yes. Okay. But this paper was
yes.
done all here.
Yes.
Right? And you look at ternary complexes,
mm-hmm.
and you use this new probe, essentially. How did you discover that particular effect?
Well, I told you, I really want to know how manganese was bound to ATP.
Right.
And I wanted to see if I could tell whether it was four. I mean, whether there were four, you start out with six waters in
right.
coordination theory, whether it was four or three. And I found out that I couldn't. So I decided to see if I could tell if I had a bigger change by having the enzyme there as well. And the enzyme might or might not be liganded to the manganese, you see.
Yes.
And lo and behold, I got this fantastic effect when I put in a protein. Now, after I had done this, I didn't understand it at all. I went to a meeting of a Gordon conference where an unprogrammed paper was presented from Bell Labs, of the group of Eisinger and Shulman and Blumberg, on the relaxation time of water in the presence of manganese nucleic acids. And they too got this very large change when it was to another macromolecule. And I was quite excited about that because I realized that it had something to do with macromolecules that this was happening. And they published that. And I advised them to publish it in Nature, which I think they did. And then my paper was after theirs. And but I was working with these, with the proteins. Actually, they had the wrong explanation, and it wasn't for several years that we figured out the right explanation. You see, the relaxation time, or rate, 1 over T1, has, is a function of the correlation time. The correlation time can be either the electron spin relaxation time or the rotational correlation time of the molecule. And there can be a contribution from a chemical rate of exchange. Now, they had explained it on the basis of the increase in the rotational correlation time, which it certainly is true when you're on the macromolecule. The manganese is now rotating with the same rotational correlation time as the whole molecule. But it turns out that that isn't the explanation. It turns out that whichever one is fastest, you see, is the one that determines the relaxation time rate. And so it turns out that the electron spin relaxation time also changes when you have the manganese bound to a macromolecule. And we actually did a lot of EPR work and determined the relaxation times, the electron spin relaxation time. And it turned out that that was the reason. That in water, it is the rotational correlation time because the electron spin relaxation time is not the determining factor. It's only when it's on a protein that the other thing becomes so small, so slow, that it's the electron spin relaxation time that modulates the interaction. Well, never mind what it was due to. I found that I had a parameter, that I could investigate and see what happened. And it was very interesting to find out all these things. And the reason I did it is because of the fact that I had originally figured out that this should be an effect that could be measured since there's lots of water. And so you don't need sensitivity. You have 55 mol of water after all.
Right.
So anyhow, we extended it in all kinds of ways and it turned out very interesting.
I just don't understand how you determine relaxation. You're looking at the water protons with the NMR.
Let me show you what you do. I have a technique. It's called the Carl-Purcell MyBoom technique that was the one we used. There are variations on the theme, but there are various ways you can do this. You can do it by, never mind.
Okay, and to build the apparatus to do this was...
Oh, Jack Lee did that.
Yes, was that terribly difficult? You didn't have to build another instrument.
There was no instrument.
Oh, I see. It wasn't a matter of just attaching something to the NMR.
The reason is that NMR really is a pain in the neck to do. And these things we could do very quickly. You can make a measurement in a minute, you see, of T1. And I could do titrations. It took very little volume. I could do it in 50 microliters, you see. And I could titrate. And I could do a whole titration in an hour. If you try to do that in a regular NMR machine, it would be difficult. This was a pulsed NMR. Don't forget, in those days...
That's right. You don't have to vary anything. You're using one frequency, one...
That's right. Well, as a matter of fact... As a matter of fact, we later, in order to figure out the mechanism, you have to do as a function of frequency and as a function to find out which tau is the determining one, you see. So we modified this instrument so that it worked at many frequencies. And we did it as a function of frequency and as a function of temperature in order to find out the mechanism of this relaxation time. I mean, what was causing the change in relaxation time? Which correlation time was responsible? Because they had different frequency dependencies. For example, a chemical exchange has no frequency dependence, and the rotational correlation time and the electron spin relaxation time have very different frequency dependence. So that's the way you find out the mechanism. So I have papers in that whole, among all those papers, which deal with this problem, and which the relaxation time was measured as a function of frequency as well as temperature.
Okay. So the information you were getting initially, you were determining the fact that there was a complex. You speculated on the kind of complex you were getting, because depending on the ion and the enzyme, you got different results.
That's right. Some enzymes bind the manganese directly, you see, and then we got a tremendous enhancement of the relaxation rate just by putting the manganese and the enzyme in together.
Right.
And then when we added
a substrate,
it went down.
Right.
But in some enzymes, nothing much happened when you just put the metal ion in, unless you had ATP there. So obviously there it was not binding directly to the enzyme.
But you were also able to determine finally the number of water molecules.
Yes.
You
had to do a frequency dependence and temperature dependence and so on.
In 1963 you received the Garvin Award.
That's right.
And in that address you more or less detailed some of these early results that you were getting.
Mm-hmm. That was published in Biochemistry.
Right. Now we jump to 1969, where you published the first paper in which you used two pure magnetic probes. That is, one in which you used a stable free radical attached to the enzyme.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also use the
manganese.
Right. Can you tell me a little bit about that work what prompted you to do that?
Well, I was looking again at spin-spin interaction. I've always believed that you get most information out of spin-spin interaction, whether it's electron spin, nuclear spin, electron spin, electron spin, or nuclear spin, nuclear spin. And indeed, that is, I think, true.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that we could find out something about the structure of this thing by having two paramagnetic species in the same complex. And indeed, it was very remarkable what happened. I expected a change in the line shape, and so on. Instead, we just got a decrease, which is quite amazing. And I remember Hardin McConnell visited here, and I showed him the results and asked him if he could explain them, and he couldn't, which made me feel better that I couldn't explain them. But my graduate student, he wasn't my graduate student then, in 69, no. Jack Lee, who later became my graduate student. He was my electronics person.
Oh, I see.
He's an electrical engineer by training.
Sort of assumed that he was your graduate student at this
point. He later decided to get a degree.
Mm-hmm.
But he was an electrical engineer. He was here when I came. Anyhow, the graduate student who was working on June Taylor, she thought it had something to do with the magic angle. Anyhow, it turned out Jack worked out the theory of it, and that it was a function of distance between the two, and that it turns out, he tells me now, that the theory was not correct. Other people have since corrected his theory. It made some assumptions which don't hold. And nevertheless, as a crude first attempt, it was quite useful. And actually, it's been referred to as the Lee theory or whatever, because he published the theory in a separate paper. And it's been used by lots and lots of experimenters to determine distances and so on.
I see. Now, he has since gone on to do work on his own in this area. Where is he?
Oh, yes, of course. He's a professor, full professor in this department now.
Oh, I knew that you had commented about consulting with him later on.
He's in charge of a project on building an experimental NMR instrument for whole body, for humans. He has that down in the building, the Blockley Hall building, in the unused swimming pool.
Oh, yes, that's right. He has an office over there, and somebody told me about their burying this huge magnet in the room. Before I ask you to sort of do a comparison of Washington and Cornell, now about a comparison of Penn and Washington.
Well, as universities, as universities, I must say that I was very disappointed in Penn, in that, as you see, when I was at Washington University, I collaborated with someone in the physics department and with two different people in the chemistry department, and they are 3.5 miles apart, those two, the medical school and the rest of the university. Mm-hmm. Here, where I was just a few blocks away, there was no interaction. That Washington University fostered that kind of interaction, and this place didn't. Mm-hmm. One reason for it is that this place is so much bigger. I mean, there are more people, much bigger school. And I think when you get to a certain size, you know, there tends to be more isolation from other departments. There are so many people within your department with whom you can collaborate and so on. Mm-hmm. But at Washington University, there was a very good spirit about this whole business of collaborating with other people.
Yeah.
And people always helping one another who were in different departments. For example, I once wanted an enzyme, and I knew Paul Berg had been playing with that enzyme. So I called him up and I got it from him, you know, that kind of thing. He was in another department, he was in microbiology at the time. In general, at Washington University, there was a very good interaction of scientists with one another, even if they weren't in the same department. That's not true here.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's one difference. Now, as far as research went, I had been in the department that was gung-ho for research, and I was in one here. So now, here, if there hadn't been any graduate students there, and there weren't any here in the Johnson Research Foundation.
Because the department couldn't take students, or?
No. The people who were at the head of it weren't really interested in training students.
I see.
They had plenty of postdocs, you see. There were, more than 20 postdocs when I got here. Mm-hmm. And the other difference.
What was the size of the staff in the research center at that time? How many other full time?
You mean principal investigators or faculty?
Yes. Right,
people.
Faculty people.
When I came, there were three besides myself.
Okay.
When we merged, there must have been 20.
Okay.
That was many years later.
Mm-hmm. 20.
Just in biophysics. Well, maybe I'm exaggerating. There were 8 assistant professors. There were about 5 or 6 full professors and a few associate professors. So mm-hmm. Of that order, anyway.
Okay. And then you merged with the biochemistry department.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a
very big department. Mm-hmm. There was something I wanted to tell you about the difference, though. Oh, yes, about my own position here. You see, at Washington University, I was there for 14 years. I never had a student, and I had one postdoc. While I was a research associate, by the way, I had one postdoc. I was a glorified postdoc myself, but anyhow, I wasn't really a postdoc. I was quite independent at that time. And this fellow came, he wanted to work with me, so he came for that reason, so he worked with me. But most of the people who came there worked with the Coreys, you see. And the few graduate students they had, and they were a few, worked either with Corey or Mrs. Corey or with one of the professors who, he actually was an associate professor, who was interested in training graduate students. But they didn't have many. They didn't have any here. They had one here when I came. And we decided to try to encourage graduate students, and so we had a committee. I was in charge of that, and we started getting graduate students. But one thing that happened here is that Chance would get all these applications, and he urged people. So the first two wanted to work with me, the postdocs I had. But often he would shunt people over to me, you see. And, well, he had so many, anyhow. But more people applied here. The place was bigger, you know, everything. So for the first time in my life, I had people working with me. Until 1960, except for that brief period when I had a postdoc, who, by the way, after 6 months was put on the faculty as an instructor. He was very good. Anyhow, I didn't have a faculty position, but he did. Well, they couldn't give me a job as an instructor, you see.
Yeah,
he was a fresh PhD.
Right.
I had worked alone there. Well, I had Tom Hughes. He was really technical. He wasn't really he was a graduate student of somebody else's. I mean, the reason he took that job is that they told him he could use the instrument to do his thesis, and he did finally get a thesis done that way. I really had had, and also I had some faculty collaboration, as you saw, in the physics and
right.
And then once in a while I collaborated with Corey and with Gertie Corey in the early days.
Sam Weissman was in physics or in chemistry?
Chemistry.
Okay.
He was in chemistry.
Yeah.
So, I had, for the first time, I had a group of my own here. The first one, postdoc I got was Al Milvan, because he'd read my stuff and wanted to work with me. Though he had been an undergraduate here, and he knew the Johnson Foundation, he'd worked here as an undergraduate. And then I got into correspondence with someone who was working on creatine kinase from Australia, Bill O'Sullivan, and I told him that if he wanted to, he could come be a postdoc here, so he did. And then, who was the next one who came along? Oh, I had an MD, whose name I've even forgotten, who was here for a year, who just wanted to learn some biochemistry. He was recommended to come to my lab, that sort of thing. Then I had this Japanese, Tada, who had been working on O18 before he came here, and who wanted to work with me. So gradually I got started, and then, you know, as I got more established, people applied as postdocs and so on. So after I got here was the first time I had maybe, and then I had some graduate students too. I brought one with me from Washington University. Well, she hadn't worked with me there, but she wanted to, and so she came here. But I haven't had many graduate students. In my whole career, I've only had six. But I've had a lot of postdocs, who many of whom were not biochemists before they came here, who were what we used to call retread jobs.
Well, in a sense, you must have had a certain familiarity with that. I mean, you kind of entered the field through the back door, too.
That's right. That's right. Well, I found that generally, the people who were chemists adjusted, except one I had who was quite advanced in years and wanted to shift, and that didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, I had one physicist who did very well, Rao, he's a recent one.
Mm-hmm.
He was quite an established person. He was an associate professor. I should tell you, as you probably know, I had a career investigatorship of the American Heart Association.
Oh, okay. I didn't distinguish the difference.
Though. Oh, there's quite a difference.
Oh, okay.
I was really independent, you see.
Okay.